Historians generally portray the 1950s as a conservative era when anti-communism and the Cold War subverted domestic reform, crushed political dissent, and ended liberal dreams of social democracy. These years, historians tell us, represented a turn to the right, a negation of New Deal liberalism, an end to reform. Well, Jennifer Delton argues that far from subverting the New Deal state, anti-communism and the Cold War enabled, fulfilled, and even surpassed the New Deal's reform agenda. Anti-communism solidified liberal political power, and the Cold War justified liberal goals such as jobs creation, corporate regulation, economic redevelopment, and civil rights. Skidmore College history professor Jennifer Delton shows how, despite President Eisenhower's professed conservatism, he maintained the highest tax rates in U.S. history, expanded New Deal programs, and supported major civil rights reforms. Her new book is Rethinking the 1950s, How Anti-Communism and the Cold War Made America Liberal. It is published by Cambridge, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jennifer Delton to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this book came at an interesting time for me because I've just started to become interested / obsessed with Eisenhower. I go from president to president, and I read a lot about Truman, and then I started to read about Eisenhower, and I'm just endlessly fascinated by this man and what he was able to do. So your book I found fascinating because it fills in a lot of the blanks for me and helped put it into some sort of context of ultimately what was before and what came after. What brought you to this decade and wanting to ask some of these questions?
Actually, what brought me to this decade and this book is not just I had a longstanding interest in anti-communism and the Cold War, but actually the political polarization that is taking place in the United States today made me think, you know, this is so interesting to look back to the 1950s to see how much bipartisan support there was and how much, I mean, bipartisan cooperation and how much bipartisan support there was for what we now call the liberal state, which is a state based on the idea that the federal government can be a beneficial progressive force for society and actually help create equality and democracy in the United States. And that idea right now seems somewhat unpopular, at least contested. And so, you know, given the political times we live in today, to look back at the 1950s, and it was kind of remarkable to see, look, no one is challenging Eisenhower saying we need to invest millions and billions of dollars to build a highway system. No Republican is saying that sounds like a bad idea.
I'm jumping the gun here, but I'm going to ask the question just because it's on my mind. I don't want to forget it. And that is, it's also laying the framework for the 60s, right? It's completely laying that infrastructure for what happened in the 60s.
Oh, absolutely. And I would go even further than that because it expands on the New Deal and then lays the groundwork for what Kennedy and Johnson will be able to do. But in many ways, because Eisenhower, a Republican, and because the moderate Republicans embraced so much of the New Deal, liberals have to go even further to the left to figure out a spot for them and for what liberal reform is going to look like. And so that's why you have someone like Lyndon Johnson, who declares war on poverty and brings in a huge government programs.
How much of this do you think is from, because of Eisenhower's background, of going through what he went through? He's a general. He has a strong military background. How much of this do you think was in him by design of his belief, and how much of it was reflective of a quote unquote changing time?
You know, I think it's both. I think that Eisenhower is a cautious, a prudent, practical man, and he was faced with times, as he himself said, you know, basically the American people like what the New Deal has given them. And at this point, you know, he would tell his conservative brother and his Republican cohorts, you know, this is the way things are now. The New Deal state is popular with voters, and it makes sense in terms of trying to have America live up to its democratic promise. So I'm going along with it. Even though he was very, you know, he would speak a conservative rhetoric. He warned big government. He disliked high taxes. He hated deficit spending. You know, so in a lot of his rhetoric, he was very conservative. But in what he actually did, and I think what he believed, he was much more.
Well, that's why I asked the question. I mean, was it cautious of sort of what he felt the American people could take, or that was politically prudent versus what he actually believed and thought was what was best for the country?
I think after doing the reading and research for this book that he actually did believe it. And I think there's two, you know, because a lot of historians have said, well, you know, he's just basically doing what's politically popular. He recognizes the New Deal is popular, so he's going along with it. But, you know, when he's trying to reconcile his principles with his governing, for instance, he's trying to lower the federal budget because he believes, you know, he doesn't want the United States to spend as much because it results in deficit spending and or high taxes. And he basically looks for reductions in the military, not in social welfare services, not in education, because he says these are two areas that we need to make our nation strong, and especially education. And his administration invests a lot of money in the university systems. And again, to keep up with the Soviet unions, which is, you know, the main argument of my book, is that we're doing these things to make democracy work for the United States. So I think when you look and see, you know, what he's choosing to cut back on and what, you know, a lot of Republicans are saying, yeah, let's cut back on the social welfare programs. Eisenhower says, hands off. That's not what we're cutting back on. We're going to cut back on the military.
And it's because of that military understanding and that post-war happy days are here again sort of mentality that he can see both sides of that coin.
Absolutely. And as he always said, you know, because I am from the military, I understand how the military is trying to get everything it can from the government in terms of budget.
When I was going to, when I was in school, in grade school, and was learning about the presidents, they kind of skipped over Eisenhower. It was sort of the bland guy. And now, as I said it earlier, is in reading about him, far from that. And it's a fascinating story. And for you as a historian and teaching history to college students, I assume that this is just a very interesting, multifaceted figure to not just him, but a time to look at.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that is, you're right about Eisenhower kind of being looked over and seen as bland. And that's one reason historians have, you know, the initial historians who were first writing about him, like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and that generation of historians, kind of said, oh, he's just a golf playing, you know, white bread, suburban president. And he didn't really do anything. He just kind of, you know, stayed the course. But that isn't true. And he was much more complicated, much more active in governing. And, of course, historians since have figured that out. And, yes, he's quite complicated person. He's really fun to teach about.
Jennifer Delton is our guest. We are talking about her new book, Rethinking the 1950s, How Anti-Communism and the Cold War Made America Liberal. It is published by Cambridge University Press. So let's talk a little bit about that, of basically what is the thrust of the book, about anti-communism and the Cold War and what it did to us and to the point where we sort of realize what's even going on. Right, like that you get at the time, because you don't really know where you're going, in the sense of what is possible.
In terms of,
well, politically and socially, of what is possible within that liberal nature of what's the end game in that?
Right. And yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there were liberals, and by liberals, when I use that term, I'm talking about people who believed that the federal government could provide benefit to society.
Right.
And so they're interested in expanding the power of the federal government to intervene in society, in the economy, for instance, and to set up social programs. And a lot of them actually did see the Cold War as an opportunity to expand the federal government, because if we had to fight, you know, anytime you have a military expansion of the federal state, what you're doing is you're expanding the federal state. It might be for military purposes, but a lot of liberals said, if we're expanding the federal state, let's get our domestic program in on that. So, and again, what you have to remember is, despite the New Deal, the United States, a lot of people in the United States are very uncomfortable with the expansion of the federal state. They like the programs, yes, Social Security and whatnot, but they're still fairly convinced by the argument that, you know, a large state can be tyrannical. So liberals have to, you know, still kind of persuade people that this large state can be beneficial and not tyrannical. And the Cold War, because it already needs the government to expand to fight the Cold War, provides them with an opportunity to expand the federal state and to take
right.
advantage of that.
And it is, that's the irony, right? If you're looking at them saying, "Oh my gosh, they're getting so big, they're getting so unwieldy. We have to deal with that. We can't allow that to happen. Look at them, look at them, look at them." And while you're doing that, you're getting bigger and bigger yourself.
Oh, absolutely. But the other thing we're saying is, if you mean by "look at them, look at the Soviet Union,"
we
don't want to become that.
Right.
The other thing we're saying, though, is that we need to make sure that democracy and capitalism actually works, that capitalism is democratic,
yeah.
that equal opportunity is established in the United States. And so if we need to use the federal government to make sure to make income distribution more equitable, for instance, because what the communists are saying is that capitalism is an unjust system that creates economic inequality. So what we need to do is show the communists that that is not the case, that capitalism creates economic opportunity and equality for all. So if we have to use the federal government to make that equality happen, we will, because we have to fight the communists. So it's the actual anti-communism that is providing the rationalization for these liberal programs.
And it seems, and if you look now, we're still trying to find that, there's still that conversation of what our place is in the world,
mm-hmm.
where we are, what are they doing, what are we doing, where are we number one, are they number one, we're still on that game.
Kind of, except the communists... What was interesting about the communist and our standoff with the communist, I mean, there are a lot of people who say, oh, it's just one, you know, other after another that we're setting up to compete with. But the communists actually claim to offer a modern, more equitable, democratic society. That was their claim. And they were competing against capitalists to see who could make the most economically productive, the most democratic society. So the end game for both the communists and democracies, capitalist democracies, were the same. And when I look around the world today, I can't find any ideology or so-called enemy that is offering the same thing that the United States is offering. If you see what I'm saying, there's not really a competitor that we can compete against to make ourselves better.
Right. So let me ask you this question. The title of the book is Rethinking the 1950s. Is it important, do you think, to rethink our history sometimes, to take these looks back to rethink the 1960s, to rethink various decades, 70s, whatever, and hopefully in doing that, learn something?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's kind of my stock in trade as a historian.
That would be my job, yes.
Yeah. And again, what I think is so interesting about the 1950s is this narrative of the 50s being so conservative, you know, hangs on in all the textbooks. But if you look at our political system today, where Obama, you know, can't even get any program through Congress, to see what Eisenhower, a Republican, did in the 1950s, you know, it's baffling. And to look at the tax rates, the way the rich were taxed at, you know, 90%, the richest were taxed at 90% over a certain amount of their income for the marginal tax rate, you know, that would not be tolerated today. And so just because of the conditions that the political arena of today really necessitates that we go back and think, you know, look, the 1950s wasn't so bad in terms, again, if you're a liberal.
Right, if you're a liberal. But again, and then conservatives will still sort of look at that time as how, do you think?
Well, it depends on what kind of conservative you are. You know, conservatives at the time, like William F. Buckley, who finds National Review during, you know, in 1955,
right.
I mean, he is a conservative who is outraged at the the growth of an expansion of the federal government under Eisenhower, a Republican. So he feels betrayed by the Republicans. So if you're a conservative that has that historical memory, and there are still are conservatives, you know, for instance, in Pat Buchanan, writing Pat right. Buchanan's magazine, American Conservative, that understand the 1950s were liberal in that what they represented was the expansion of the military-industrial complex, which for conservatives like Pat Buchanan, that equals that's not conservative. You know,
and it shows how those labels change over time, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, our label of conservative and liberal of using a scope of the 1950s is very different from what we would use today, and quite frankly, very different than what we would have used 15 years ago.
Absolutely. And that's the hardest thing, you know, like to try to keep track of all of these things. So, for instance, George W. Bush, who many people I know regard as very conservative, but he, when he is authorizing the war in Iraq, he quotes Harry Truman,
right.
who is a liberal.
Yeah.
So it is the labels are all mixed up. If
kind of gets kind of mushy.
It gets kind of mushy. It's always hard. You always have to back up and explain and delineate and try to define what you're talking about.
One of the things that's a major part of the book, and I don't want to in our closing moments, I do want to get to it. And that, of course, is the civil rights movement, which was very much a part of this time, obviously, and the conversation.
Yeah. And this is an example of what you were getting at with Eisenhower. It's pretty well established. He didn't support government legislation for civil rights. He believed in civil rights. He believed that African Americans deserved equal opportunity, but he didn't believe it was the role of the federal government to do that. But he put into positions of power people who did. So his attorney general was Herbert Brownell, a man he knew was interested in furthering a civil rights agenda. And indeed, Herbert Brownell persuades Eisenhower in 1957 to sponsor the first civil rights bill legislation since Reconstruction. So he says one thing, but he is open to a lot in terms of civil rights.
And when we talk about that, how much do you think that the people were, and this goes back to an earlier question of how much do you think it was him following the mood of the people and or them being led?
With civil rights, Eisenhower didn't lead. But what he did do is, because there were so many calls for civil rights, and particularly because of the Cold War.
Right, I don't even mean him specifically, but just sort of the movement. But
yeah,
yes.
I mean, there is the civil rights movement, but what the U.S. government is really responding to in the late 1950s is the Soviet Union charging that the United States is a society of white supremacy and that the decolonizing nations will not benefit from going with a racist nation like the United States. So the U.S. government has to address the racism. Now, Eisenhower, even though a lot of historians say he didn't lead, he did take what steps he could constitutionally. I mean, he understood all the states' rights arguments that the southern states were making,
right.
But he said, look, in areas where I, the president, have control, I am going to desegregate. So he actually desegregates the army. Even though we understand that Harry Truman signed the order, but didn't take any steps to actually do it. Eisenhower is able to desegregate the U.S. Army, plus the Army bases, plus Army schools, plus Army Navy yards all around the United States. So he's just saying, you know, I don't want to cause any constitutional battle, but in those areas where the president does have the jurisdiction, we will make sure that integration, racial integration occurs. And he does follow through on that. He's very effective.
Here's a talk show question for you. Ready? If in the course of writing this book, I mean, does your opinion of the guy change at all?
Of Eisenhower?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is always the question. It's hard to work with people. And when I say work with people, I mean read about them
sure.
and read their papers without having a sympathy for them. even if you're working with someone who's an attractive personality, because you just you're and as a historian, this is what we're taught to do, and what we do is we try to place ourselves in the situation that those people faced, and to look at the world through the restraints that they faced, and so I've become very sympathetic to Eisenhower, but I also still obviously recognize his flaws.
Well said. The name of the book is Rethinking the 1950s, How Anti-Communism and the Cold War Made America Liberal. The book is published by Cambridge University Press. Jennifer Delton is a professor of history at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. And it's a great pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. Great pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Rethinking the 1950s, How Anti-Communism and the Cold War Made America Liberal. It is published by Cambridge. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.